Hello. 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 Hello.
Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on 720 WGN.
Good evening, everyone. Karen Conti here. We have a jam-packed show tonight. Very, very interesting guests. At 7:30, we are going to be talking to the author of a newly released book called Manson Exposed. He covered the case 50 years ago when the Tate-LaBianca murders occurred. He has a lot of firsthand knowledge and information about the murders, and he's come out with a book, kind of a follow-up with some of the new evidence and new facts that have been unveiled. So that's about 7:30. And about 8 o'clock, we will be talking in light of today is National Son and Daughter Day, and it's the day where you're supposed to, value your relationship with your children, which is a wonderful thought. But for many people who are alienated from their children, there's a thing called parental alienation. I've talked about it on my show quite a bit, and we're going to be talking to someone who's the past president of the Parental Alienation Organization about what happens when you're not speaking to your children and while your children are not speaking to you, how to kind of get that resolved or how to prevent it from happening in the first place. Parental alienation, very interesting topic. And then we'll be taking all of your legal calls. We have a lot of things in the news that you can ask me about. We've got Governor Blagojevich, who might be pardoned by Donald Trump. We thought maybe it would happen last week. We're thinking maybe it's going to happen this week. What do you think about that? I'd like to hear your thoughts on that in the 8 o'clock hour. And we also have the issue of Jeffrey Epstein, who was found, they say, killed, dead in his cell. They say it was a suicide. And I'd like people to weigh in on that and what your thoughts are on that 8 o'clock hour. But right now, we have a very interesting topic, and that is, how old is too old to be the president of the United States? We have so many leaders who are vying for president. Joe Biden, 76 years old. Bernie Sanders, 77. Elizabeth Warren, 69. Donald Trump is 72. And there's Mike Gravel. Is that his name? Is it Gravel or Gravel? 89 years old. And again, I'm not saying that they are too old. I'm questioning everybody out there. What do you think? Do you think there is an age that is too old to be president? We know that the Constitution says that you must be 35 years old in order to run for president, and John F. Kennedy was the youngest president. Should there be a limit on your age to be president, and are there good reasons for it or not? And with us to discuss this really interesting issue is Dr. Ziad Nasruddin, who is a psychiatrist and the creator of the Montreal Cognitive Assessment, which is a way to screen people for early dementia. And Donald Trump took the test and announced to the world that he got a perfect score. Welcome to the show. Hi, doctor. How are you?
Hello, Karen. How are you? I'm a neurologist, by the way, It's okay. I also deal with psychiatric issues as well.
Okay. I'm sorry. Now we got that right.
No problem.
And so tell me about this test that you devised, the Montreal Cognitive Assessment Test. Tell me how widely is this test used? I looked at the research, and it looks like it's used all over the world.
Yeah, the Montreal Cognitive Assessment, we call it also in short the MoCA test. I devised it almost 20 years ago when I finished my specialization in Alzheimer's at UCLA after my neurology specialization. And it covers most cognitive domains that can be affected with the aging and with the dementia. So it usually covers domains like short-term memory, concentration, attention, orientation, calculation, abstract thinking, etc.
And generally,
it's being used around the world. I mean, almost in 200 countries. It's been so popular because it's very short, 10 minutes, and it is very sensitive for early impairment compared to the existing tests.
Can anyone take this test, doctor, or do you have to go to a hospital or a doctor to have it implemented?
It was designed to be done by a health professional, not to be self-administered, but we're working right now on a self-administered version.
And what does it test for, and what does it not test for?
It detects cognitive impairment, meaning short-term memory loss, which is common when we get older. But what we're looking for, we're trying to detect actually Alzheimer's disease, which is the most common cause of memory impairment as we get older, obviously after age 70. Also detects impairment in concentration, executive functions, planning, organization, calculation, and abstract thinking, as well as visual-spatial skills. But all this in very short time, like 10 minutes each, minute we test a different function with a different item that assesses a different brain area. So it's a quick brain cognitive scan, we call it.
Let's, and I want to continue this conversation. I want to talk to you a little bit about what signs there are of dementia and Alzheimer's. I want to talk about the difference between the two diagnoses. And then I want to talk about my topic, about can we test for a competent president? And looking at the skill set that a president has to have, how does this kind of test weigh in on whether or not the person is too old to run? Can you hold for us for a minute?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, we're going to take a break. We'll come back with Dr. Nasruddin.
Fairy tales can come true. It can happen to you if you're young at heart.
We're talking about the aging process, and we're talking to Dr. Ziad Nasruddin, who's a neurologist who developed the Montreal Cognitive Assessment, which is a way to screen people for early signs of dementia. Welcome back to the show. Thank you for joining me. So can you describe a little bit about, people use the term dementia and Alzheimer's. Is one a subset of the other? What is the difference?
Yes, dementia is a general term that that comprises Alzheimer's. There's different types of dementia. We call dementia of the Alzheimer type. You can have dementia of the vascular type. But we're not using anymore much the word dementia, as it's becoming more and more found to be too judgmental. And so we're now using Alzheimer's disease. We're using vascular cognitive impairment, where we're trying to relate to different causes of dementia. So dementia is just loss of capacity, of cognitive capacity, and inability of the subject to be able to take care of themselves. This is what means dementia in general, but can be multiple causes for it.
There, human beings are living longer, we know that. And my question is, because human beings are living longer, does that mean they are staying fresh mentally longer? Meaning at age maybe 50 years ago, people in their 70s might have been having some impairment, and now they're not because they're living longer. Does that make sense?
I mean, I think we haven't been exploring cognitive impairment in the past as much as we are now, because the life expectancy was much shorter. So whenever they would get more impaired in their cognition, we'd call them their senile or senility, and Alzheimer's disease wasn't that recognized as a cause of mental impairment or cognitive impairment as we age. But we do see that the frequency of cognitive impairment is extremely high at age 75, almost 20 to 25% of the population at 75 has dementia, and most commonly is Alzheimer's. So it's one out of four almost, and one out of five at 75, which is the current age range, I mean, that we have for the candidates. So that's why I think it is concerning to see that we are having candidates at that age. But at the same time, we should not, I think, put a limit to that, but we should probably be screening candidates for this possibility of cognitive impairment.
Now, mandatory retirement seemed to be, when I first started practicing law 33 years ago, there was mandatory retirement all over the place in all kinds of jobs. And I think I've seen that diminish quite a bit. Only I see it in fields where perhaps, you know, your physical ability to do the job might pose a problem. What do you think about mandatory retirement? Knowing what you know about the brain and how the brain ages, do you think that making hard and fast rules for people in the workplace is a good idea or a bad idea?
I think it would be a bad idea to promote mandatory retirement, because the brain, if it's not being worked, it will decay faster and will not regenerate as fast or not create synapses. Most studies have shown that people who retire, they get worse after retirement physically and cognitively. So mental activity with the work is probably keeping the brain sharper. So I think it's better to keep people at work and to keep encourage them not to have mandatory retirement, especially for activities that require mental capacities.
So for my listeners, and we have some older listeners here, staying on that topic, for those of you out there who are listening and you're retired or you're retiring or, you know, you're taking it easy, doctor, what would be some activities that people should engage in that really are good for preventing this kind of decay or diminution in cognitive abilities?
And the best activity is actually socialization, like meeting people, going out, discussing the news, being aware of what's happening. So socialization seems to be the most important stimulant for the neurons. We can also do like card games or play other like bridge or other types of stimulating mental activities, or to do a volunteer work, or to be part of a administration of a building, or to do some activities that are require memorization and that will stimulate the neurons.
And how have those things been tested, where you take people who are active, say, in social things, active playing, doing crossword puzzles and doing those types of things, and just comparing them with people who are not doing those things, and you've looked at and tested them for their aptitudes?
Yeah, actually, multiple studies have shown, but there are retrospective studies, you know, showing that the patients with dementia were not involved as much as patients without dementia in these activities in the 10 to 20 years before the dementia started. So it's there's a lot of indirect studies showing the benefit of being active.
And for those of my listeners who are approaching those age groups, are there things other than what you're talking about, staying busy, staying active, being social, testing out your brain and using it, are there some other physical things that help the brain function,
yes,
nutrition-wise, physical activity-wise?
Yes. Yeah, nutrition has been a lot studied, and most of the time we have come up with recommendation that the Mediterranean diet, meaning that it's fish based and more vegetables and fruits and nuts and berries, have the best like protection for prevention compared to other types of diets, and compared to the red meat, compared to the fat, compared to the dairy products. So these have been shown to be helpful. In terms of the exercise, it's physical activity has been shown in multiple studies, but short-term studies that patients who are physically active or subjects who are physically active are less prone, if they do 20 minutes a day or more physical activity, to get dementia or cognitive impairment.
So it sounds like just a good, healthy diet, good, healthy exercise always seems to be the answer to a lot of our...
There is hearing, there's also hearing impairment, because hearing impairment seems to be more frequent, I mean, when we get older, and we get less stimulation to the brain if we are hearing impaired. So hearing impairment seems to be something unrecognized, and that's causing a lot of less stimulation, the more isolation if we're not hearing the conversation. So it's something that should be looked into. And also sleep apnea is a common problem when we get older. So if we're getting less oxygen while we're sleeping, we might have more cognitive impairment when we're awake the next day.
Ah, that's very interesting, and it makes sense that if you know people who have hearing problems and don't want to get that hearing aid, they are excluded,
exactly.
And people get kind of angry with them because it's frustrating to be around someone who may not be hearing, and people tune out. And very, very interesting. And again, inheritance. How if you look at your parents and you see if they were active mentally in their 80s and they're doing well, does that bode well for you?
Yes, that's for sure. There are some genetic factors that increase the likelihood of getting dementia, which is, we call the ApoE gene, ApoE4 gene, and up to probably 20% of patients with Alzheimer's compared to some 4% of general population have that gene. So there's increased likelihood of dementia if you do have that gene. But even if you do have that gene, we can still decrease the risk of Alzheimer's if you do those stimulating activities. And also there's another important prevention is patients who have diabetes, high blood pressure and cholesterol, if they treat those conditions, their risk of Alzheimer's also does decrease, as its circulation to the brain is also important to improve cognitive functions.
Interesting. Well, let's talk about the topic at issue, which is the president. When a presidential candidate would, for instance, you know, just hypothetically take your test, I'm not talking about anyone in particular here because I'm not going to get political, but if a presidential candidate takes your test and scores perfectly on it and does well, does that mean that person you believe is mentally fit to be a president, or is this test just not something that tests that kind of those kinds of issues?
I mean, the test is useful at that age because how common these, how prevalent, I mean, the conditions like Alzheimer's are at the age of 72 or 75. So I think it's important to make sure that these cognitive functions are okay. And the test is very sensitive for mild impairment. So it is reassuring if someone scores well on that test. But the test does not obviously, I mean, check for fitness to be present. It's a test for cognitive function, specific one that, like I enumerated before.
So it might be a start. It might be one prong of something that would be helpful to at least eliminate the idea that one out of four people over the age of, I think, 75, you know, might have these problems. So this would be a good sign. But, you know, I suppose my opinion on these, you know, to be president, there's so many things you need to do. You need to be a good decision maker, which doesn't always mean, you know, I watch these debates and, you know, some of people are very quick-witted. But, you know, being quick-witted might and quick-talking may not be a good sign. Maybe you want a president who's going to think and be a little more cerebral, or even the physical, this physical stress on a president who's flying to different countries, who's staying up late, who's reading things. I mean, those seem to be important factors as well.
I think, yeah, the personality of the president talks a lot about what type of personality he is. Is he the type that is empathetic and he listens to the population and he follows what the people want and he's considerate and reasonable and logical in his thoughts and in his propositions? Cognition is obviously a basic thing that we need to have, like as a minimum, to be able to be a president. But the rest is mostly personality, I think, and the logic and the attributes that are not necessarily due in relation to the memory and language functions. Yeah.
Well, I think that my prediction is that into the future we're going to have some expert who's going to come up with a test, the presidential fitness test, and it's going to be a physical test, a mental test, a personality disorder test, a verbal test, and that each candidate is going to have to take it, and we'll see how they score. What do you think about that?
I think it's going to be tough to have that test approved by both parts of the Congress, that they will be both agreeing to have such a test that would be reliable enough. Because, as I said, I don't think the fitness to be president can be easily measured by a score. I think some of the elements are definitely difficult to estimate, and I think it's mainly the ideas that the president is proposing that the population has to decide. But maybe they were telling us, I mean, the media, that the MoCA test is maybe too simple for the level of intellect of the president, which is correct as well. And we were working on an executive version of the test, because we do have an illiterate version of the test, MoCA, which is for illiterate patients. And we have the standard MoCA that the president passed. But we're working on a high-level one for executives like physicians, judges, presidents. So this is would be a good idea to have something a little bit more enhanced or more complex. Yeah.
Sounds great. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Nasruddin. Thank you so much for joining us. And stay tuned. We're going to be talking about the Charles Manson murders when we return. Friday was the 50th anniversary of the Tate-LaBianca murders. They shocked the nation. On August 8th, 1969, an actress, Sharon Tate, beautiful woman, up and coming, was 8.5 months pregnant and the wife of director Roman Polanski. Four people, under the instruction and apparently control of a drifter and sociopath, Charles Manson, broke into her Beverly Hills home and killed everyone inside. The next night, to make it look like part of a race war, Manson ordered his followers to a different address in Los Angeles and killed again. These murders shook the nation. And Charles Manson was charged with murder and died in jail just a little bit ago. There is a new book out in light of the 50th anniversary. It's called Manson Exposed, and it's by Ivor Davis, who has covered this case for a long, long period of time, joining us tonight. Hi, Ivor. How are you?
Hello. Is this WGN?
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. I'm going to put you on hold. Let's see. Where is Ivor? Hi, Ivor. Welcome to the show.
Okay, thank you, Karen.
Hi. I thought that voice was a little too high for you.
Yes.
So tell me, the book is very good. It's got a lot of facts and a lot of details. I highly recommend it to anyone who's read Helter Skelter or any of the other books on the issue. How did you become interested in the case? Because you've been covering it for a long time.
Yeah, well, my job back in 1969 was as a foreign correspondent in America on the West Coast for the London Daily Express, and those were the days when the Express had 4 to 5 million readers a day, and those were the days when, you may recall, people actually read newspapers. I mean, pardon my cynicism.
Yes, no, totally agree.
So I was a correspondent, and of course I rushed out to the house because the wire service was saying there'd been mass murders. We didn't know anything. I got there and we hung around until we discovered the gory news of who had been murdered and who the victims were.
It must have been terrifying at that time. And what I kind of forgot about in these murders is I think we all kind of remember it being that Manson was they found out right away, but it was a little bit of time before they found out who did these crimes.
You're exactly right, Karen, because believe it or not, it wasn't for 4 months after the murders that they finally honed in on Manson. And the way they did it was, you know, a stroke of luck for them because they were baffled. And what happened was that Susan Atkins, who was one of the killers at the Sharon Tate house, went to jail on another murder charge for the murder of a musician, Gary Hinman, which took place in July 1969. And while she was in jail, she started boasting to her cellmates, and they didn't believe her at first, but then they realized she was telling the truth because she had such enormous details about the murders. She told the cellmates told the cops interviewed Susan Atkins, and bang, the case was solved.
Now, people, again, some younger people who think of Charles Manson as being this evil sociopath, think that he actually murdered people, but he did not murder anybody. He was in charge of this cult, and I want to ask you a little bit about the cult. There's so many facts about the lead up to the murders, but was he a person who was capable of murdering himself, or was he just the kind of guy who motivated people through whatever charismatic or whatever strange pull he had?
I have no doubt that Charles Manson was capable of murder himself, but he was very clever, and he knew that if he didn't implicate himself in the actual murders, and he didn't, and he did, but let me, if I may, take a moment to explain what I just said. Manson was never at the Sharon Tate house, so his hands were supposedly clean. On the second night of the murders, 50 years ago this month, he went with the members of his family to the Rosemary and Lino LaBianca house. He went into the house. He tied up Mr. and Mrs. LaBianca. He left them in the house. He went back to the car. He said to Charles Tex Watson and the two girls that were with him, Leslie Van Houten and Patricia Krenwinkel, go back in and finish them off. And Charlie Manson then drove off, leaving the killers to hitchhike back to the Spahn Movie Ranch where they were living at the time, where Spahn Movie Ranch was on the edge of Hollywood. So, technically speaking, he didn't wield the knife or pull the trigger, but he was the mastermind behind these terrible crimes.
And remind our listeners what the motive was. And I think one of the reasons that it was such a long time period for them to catch the murders here is that there didn't seem to be any real motive.
There didn't seem to be any real motive, but you mentioned in your introduction, Karen, that he did it to make it look like a race war, and that was the thing. But part of the other reason was this, that his friend Robert Beausoleil was in prison for a murder to a musician called Gary Hinman on July 27th, 1969, and Manson felt guilty because he told Beausoleil to kill Hinman. So he tried to make these two additional murders, the ones on August the 9th and 10th, to look like that the same gang of killers had killed Hinman, killed Sharon Tate and the others, and basically tried to lay the blame on black militants. And believe it or not, it was a crazy thought, and when you think of a man murdering two lots of people to lay the blame on somebody else, I mean, it's ridiculous, but that was the actual circumstances, according to what I knew at the time and in my research.
We're talking to Ivor Davis, who is the author of Manson Exposed, a fabulous book on the whole issue of Charles Manson and the whole time period during these murders 50 years ago. Now, Charles Manson was a little guy. He wasn't particularly good looking. He wasn't particularly successful at anything in his life. But there is this idea, and it's throughout your book, that he could get women to do whatever he wanted. And he could get nice women, women who weren't bad women, attractive women, to literally have sex with all kinds of people for no good reason, to live in this ranch, which was sort of a horrible place and with spoiled food and not enough clothing, and do all these horrible things. How does a guy like Manson get people to do these things?
Well, Charles Manson, as you described so well, was a small guy, but he survived in the prison of hard knocks. And he started out as a young child, almost, being in reform schools. He was brutalized there. And then when he went to the grown-ups prison, if you like, he managed to survive by a silver tongue. And, of course, he studied up on all these how to succeed in business without really trying. I mean, that sounds weird, but he learned whatever his canniness, his Machiavellian skills in jail to survive. And when he came out, he found all these young women who were ripe for the plucking, and they were runaways, and they were from good homes, but they were looking for the meaning of life. They were looking for a father figure. Manson served that purpose in all respects. He was their father, he was their lover, he was their dictator. And by giving them and feeding them regular doses of LSD and mescaline, he had them do whatever he wanted to do, and he loved doing that, and that was his skill, if you like, a crazy skill, although it was.
We're talking to Ivor Davis. He wrote the book Manson Exposed, and this is the 50th anniversary of the Tate-LaBianca murders. We're going to talk more about it. If you have any questions for our author, give us a call here at 312-981-7200. We're going to take a break. Coming up, the stories that matter with Roger Badish from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio.
Don't do anything illegal. Beware of the eagle that's right in the middle of your back. Don't be legal. Got you in a sack.
That's the musical genius of Charles Manson. We're here with Ivor Davis, who wrote the book Manson Exposed, A Reporter's 50-Year Journey into Madison Murder. Welcome back to the show. Did Manson, I Googled some of his music. It's pretty horrible, is it not?
It's not the greatest. I mean, you rented him, you described him as a musical genius, and I think there was a lace of irony in your voice.
Dripping.
He wasn't a musical genius, and in fact, he would love to have been a musical genius. He would love to have been a rock star, because if he'd been a rock star, I honestly believe you and I would not be talking today. But he fell by the wayside, even though he had great connections with Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys and Terry Melcher, the son of Doris Day, who wanted at one time to record him for a possible recording contract. But Manson didn't quite have it.
Interesting that people really kind of took to him. There must have been something about his music, because I couldn't find it. But of course, I'm not a musical expert, and it just seemed pretty bad.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of average stuff. Although, you know, it's a funny business, the musical business, as you probably know, because Neil Young, who was a pretty good musician himself, at one time said in the early days when he saw Charlie, he thought he was kind of a Bob Dylan in the making, but he was not, of course. He was a killer in the making.
Right. You know, the followers are the interesting part. Can you tell us a little bit about the followers, and in particular, I'm interested in Squeaky Fromm, which name probably is one that listeners would remember most, because she went on to try to assassinate President Gerald Ford. Can you tell our listeners who these women were, who went to jail, and what happened to them eventually?
Well, I mean, Squeaky Fromm and Sandra Good came from pretty good homes. I mean, although sometimes in many cases of the girls like Leslie Van Houten and Patricia Kremwinkle, who were the convicted killers, they came from broken homes. But as I mentioned a few minutes ago, I think they were looking for something, and they weren't sure what they were looking. And Manson intuitively knew give them the gobbledygook explanation, and they would swallow it. I mean, they were intelligent young women. And, you know, as I said, they came from well-to-do homes. They had good good backgrounds and pretty good educations. But somehow Manson knew, you know, he knew every one of the girls' Achilles heel. And as a result, he pushed the right buttons, said the right things. I mean, one of the girls, Patricia Krenwinkel, was not a very attractive young woman, never been with a man. The first time she met Charlie, he said she was the most beautiful girl in the world, made love to her, and she was hooked from that day. So Manson could give the girls the messages he knew they wanted to hear, and as soon as they heard it...
Would you call this a cult? I know the word cult is used.
Well, yes, I think you could call it a cult because the mesmerizing figure was Manson. I mean, he was the boss. I mean, he treated the girls with love and tenderness and horrible, horrible cruelty. But they would do anything for him. And that is a cult leader. I mean, look at Jim Jones. Jim Jones, of course, as I'm sure you know, was the guy who persuaded, 900 followers to drink poison Kool-Aid, and they all killed themselves. So the cult leaders can get people to do the undoable, the unbelievable.
And here in Chicago, we have the R. Kelly story. And if you believe what we've seen in the documentaries, there was the same dynamic in that we had a person who was charismatic and very successful in his case. You know, so that's why I kind of see, I can understand somewhat the girls thinking, oh, this is a star. I've seen him all over. He makes millions of dollars. He thinks I have talent. He thinks I'm beautiful.
Yes.
But Charles Manson wasn't really a success. In fact,
no. I mean, that's, you know, you use that comparison, not really the comparison, but you know what I mean. But R. Kelly was a worldwide name, and any of these girls, these kind of latter day groupies, obviously succumbed very deeply to R. Kelly. I don't know the case that well, but Manson did not have success. Manson was not a rock star. Manson was a guy with a smooth tongue who knew what to say to the right person. And just literally was a magical enchanter. I mean, he was the Pied Piper of horror.
Yeah. Let's go back to Squeaky Fromm. Because she wasn't, am I right that she was not prosecuted as one of the followers?
No, she was not. And you point this out very, very clearly. You've got to sort the accused and convicted killers from the girls that are still around. Squeaky is still around. And as you pointed out, before I say as you pointed out, she was the one who confronted me in the courtroom or outside the courtroom on the first day of the trial, and she knew I was not a Manson devotee, and I'd written an early book about Manson and his crazy antics. She looked at me and she said, do you know what it feels like to have a knife slip down your throat? Well, to be honest with you, coming from this sweet, angelic girl made it more horrible. And I took the threat seriously. And then, as you pointed out, for whatever reason, she went on to kill President Gerald Ford, spent time in jail, and finally, after, 20, 25 years, was paroled. She's still out there. She's still out there with one or two other, believe it or not, young women, or now they're old women, who believe in the Manson doctrine.
They still do. They still are brainwashed.
They do.
Wow.
They are.
Ben, can you play that little clip that I pulled from the internet? This is just a little bit from our friend Charles Manson here.
When I stand on the mountain and I say, do it, it gets done. If it don't get done, then I'll move on it. And that's the last thing in the world you want me to do.
Every one of you out there has tried to kill me for the last 25 years, and I'm still here. Ha, ha, ha. Now what?
So and you can actually look on the internet and see him talking with the swastika on his face. Was Charles Manson really as crazy as he looked and acted, or was this just a kind of a show he put on?
Well, I think it was a bit of both. And in fact, the segment you just played is really quite fascinating, because the Manson legend, if you like, the horrible legend, would not be around today. But don't forget, when he was in prison, he was in prison for life. He was convicted and he was sent to die in a gas chamber, and then the penalty, death penalty, was abolished in California. Manson had the opportunity to be on primetime television with people like Diane Sawyer and Tom Snyder, Geraldo Rivera, Ron Reagan Jr. And Manson brilliantly manipulated his interviewers, like you just played that segment. Manson was an actor. He gave them their money's worth. And the other thing I always like to think is that you or I and many of your listeners would not want Charles Manson in our living room. God forbid. But Manson invaded the living rooms thanks to these primetime shows. And he delivered. He gave them what they wanted. The bogeyman in captivity, a monster, great quotes. Perfect, perfect candidate.
Well, and I think a lot of these sociopaths, and if you know my history, I have represented a particularly evil sociopath here in Chicago. And they, in some ways, there's a certain pride that they have, because this is their claim to fame. This is what they are, and they want to live up to it. And it's a strange dynamic, because you and I would be, wow, I don't want to be known to have killed 33 boys or have a swastika on my head. But that, for him, was his, that was his identity, I suppose.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question now? Because I knew you were savvy on that front, but I didn't realize how experienced you were. I mean, do you, when you talk, when you've represented, when you've been in front of these sociopaths or whatever you want to call them, is there a common denominator in their personalities and in what they do to their victims?
I think the personality of the personalities of the ones who I have represented or have had the opportunity to speak to, they are very normal in what they say and how they say it. There is a lack of affect, which is really what the antisocial personality is about. And these are people who don't really have true emotion, so they fake it. So they are very good at saying, oh, I'm sorry to hear that your mother is sick, or I'm sorry to see that you have a broken hand. But they really don't care about, in fact, they can murder you and eat a ham sandwich while you're bleeding to death. So, you know, these people are, they on the outside are very average. And I get asked that all the time, like, did they seem to be evil? And,
yes.
And they're, none of them was like Charles Manson. Charles Manson played up that whole "I'm crazy, don't get it under my skin, or I'm going to do something." You know.
Yeah. Well, you've hit it the nail on the head there. This lack of affect is really the clue, as you've noticed and you know from your experience. But Manson loved to be on stage. He loved to be the cameras rolling. He loved to perform. And whenever he was interviewed, you got your money's worth, because deep down inside, he was a performer as well as being a madman.
Now, while he was in prison, we only have a few minutes left, but while Manson was in prison, was there anything remarkable that he did or said? And I'm going to ask you the other question that a lot of my friends who knew I was going to interview you, did he have any children?
Yes, he did have children. You know, I must tell you a very quick story, if I may.
I know
you're running out of time. I was at a book signing party today in Beverly Hills, and all of a sudden, one of the hosts said, there's a guy called Michael Bruner going to come along. And I thought, oh, my God, are you serious? Michael Bruner is one of Manson's sons.
Oh.
From Mary Bruner. Well, the host called up the guy who was going to bring Bruner and said, look, Bruner still thinks his father was wrongly accused. Do you want him to come along to your book event? And I said, look, I'd love to meet him, but I'm not going to turn him around, am I? He's going to be supporting his father. I mean, that was pretty freaky. And Bruner, to be honest, is a victim of his father. And he said only he learnt about all the nasty things that he did much later in life. So there are victims, the sons and the offspring, and they're still around, and some of them still believe Charlie is innocent.
What is your personal opinion on whether or not he should have gotten the death penalty? I mean, coming from England, I think Europe is not, they don't use the death penalty at all anymore. But
I mean, in a way, think the death penalty is barbaric. But in a way, and I think I mentioned a moment ago, if Charles Manson had been executed when he was supposed to be executed, I mean, you know, 1970, 71, 72, we wouldn't be having this conversation, because in jail he milked it for all his worth. So, and some of the girls really are sympathetic figures, because they were so young, they were so manipulated so young, and I can feel some sympathy for them. But every time I do, people say, well, what about the victims? What about the sympathy for them?
Right. Ivor Davis, thank you so much, and good luck with your book. Where can listeners get your book?
Well, they can get it, of course, on Amazon, or they can find out more than they ever wanted to know about me and buy the book. Buy the book on www.ivordavisbooks.com.
And we'll post that on our website.
Thank you very much, Karen.
Right.
Good talking to you.
All right, good talking to you, and good luck.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Welcome back. We're going to be taking your legal calls a little bit later today, 8:30 p.m. You can call in and you can talk about whatever you want. You have legal questions. You want to talk about Jeff Epstein, about the Blagojevich possible pardon by Donald Trump. Anything you want to talk about, I'm happy to answer or weigh in on. The number is 312-981-7200. 981-7200, or text me to that same number. But right now, we're going to talk about an issue that is near and dear to my heart. Today is National Son and Daughter Day. I think all of us who have children take for granted that you have a healthy, wonderful, loving relationship. But for people who have been alienated from their children and severed from their children's lives for no good reason, it's a sad day. It's a sad day when you're not speaking to your child. This is a very dangerous and emerging mental health crisis, parental alienation. It basically happens when one parent turns a child against the other parent by basically brainwashing them, saying bad things about them, saying things to make them afraid of the other parent. If that resonates with you out there, it's a very common situation. And in extreme cases of separation and divorce, a child could be permanently in a situation where there's no relationship at all. It has horrible, long-lasting effects on both, obviously, the parents and the children. And here to talk about parental alienation is Jill Ajizi. She's an alienated mother herself, the president, past president of the Parental Alienation Awareness Organization, and the author of A Look of Love. She regularly appears on television and radio to talk about this issue. Hi, Jill. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Karen.
My heart goes out to you. I've known you for so many years. I have met your children.
So many.
many. And I know that every day like this is hard. Every day is hard. But days like Mother's Day and all of these times have to tug at you. But you've done such a good job of making people aware of it. And so let's talk a little bit about the syndrome. Can you give us an example of how parental alienation starts in a family?
Sure. And it most often occurs in adversarial divorce, and it can occur in an intact marriage. So there are many different scenarios, but I would say the highest percentage of parental alienation occurs in adversarial divorce. So it begins when there is a lot of conflict, and one parent is trying to gain emotional justice over the other. When everything else fails, the last bastion of the fort are the children. So using those children as weapons to engage the other in battle and to try to rip those children away from that parent, whether it be a man or a woman, because this isn't a gender issue. It affects men and women equally. Women have just been a little less vocal, but are now really starting to come around, come out of the closet, so to speak. It's such a really horrible thing to be a mother without your children, and there's such a stigma attached to it. So a lot of women haven't really taken their seat on the bus to discuss that issue. But it begins sometimes very innocently with people not understanding what they're doing when they're making comments about one parent to their children. And then there are parents who have the playbook, who understand exactly what they're doing, and they begin to plant seeds in the minds of the child to erase memory, to erase that parent, to erase that parent's family from that child's life. And it's a very, very damaging process for the child, and it's very long-lasting.
And, you know, we see it, you know, we see innocent things where, you know, mom rolls her eyes about dad, or
sure.
dad says, well, your mom's too busy to talk to you. And you see that, and that's not good. That's never a good thing. But when you take it to the other extreme where, and let me just say this, I practice law in this area of family law, and I know that the system actually encourages people to be polarized. So I know that I will see my child more if I show that I'm the better parent. And in order to show right. I'm the better parent, I'm going to say bad things about the other parent without thinking of the damage that it's doing to the children. But it's to the point where the children absorb it. They you know, mm-hmm. like you said, the memories are erased, and then they start treating that other parent with disrespect and the like.
Horrible disrespect. And there are really, there are eight signs that were sort of categorized by Richard Gardner, who in 1985 termed the phrase parental alienation, or founded the phrase parental alienation and parental alienation syndrome. And then there are 17 signs that you can look at that I encourage people to check off when they're an alienated parent that the other parent can be doing. So it would involve things like not bringing the child to visitation because they've booked something else for the child at the time of visitation, interfering with visitation time, changing the child's last name. You know, there's all kinds of things. So if these 17 things are happening, or 10 of them are happening, you can be pretty sure that parental alienation is rearing its ugly head. And you hit the nail right on the head. This system encourages parental alienation. Why? Because the system has created a cottage industry for itself. And as long as there's conflict in as long as these middle and upper class people can be kept in the court system, the money keeps flowing.
It's just awful. And false accusations are made, too. And you see this all the time where, and it goes both ways. Like you said, it's gender neutral. You see people making allegations of sexual abuse or physical abuse, and the child gets taken away, and there's a DCFS involvement, and then there's investigations. Yeah. And meantime, the child is now afraid of the other parent and may even believe that the child's been abused by the other parent. That's how deep it goes. Because, you know, if you think about it, your child loves two people the most, dad and mom, right? No matter what. And if one parent who they love right up there is saying bad things about the other person that they love, that's basically telling them that half of them is bad.
You're exactly right in that. And that goes back to Amy Baker. Amy Baker, who's one of the leading mental health experts in the world. There's very few, just a handful. But she says to turn a child against a parent is to turn a child against himself, because you're losing half of that child. And it's just so extremely damaging. And if these people could see what they're doing and the results that it has in the adult life of these children, they might think twice. But so many of these people who are alienators have had damaging childhoods or early adolescence, have had something happen to them, such as sexual abuse or a traumatic divorce, where they were alienated. And this is a generational thing.
Absolutely.
So if alienators, you know, alienate their children, then their children become alien. And it's just a cycle that is very difficult to break.
Jill, can we just briefly, I just have a few seconds left, but I would like you to just give some advice to people who may be in this situation or may see that this is happening to them in a high conflict divorce. What are some bullet points that they can do to make sure this doesn't happen or to help their situation?
Well, I think if it's early on and you think there's a possibility that your soon-to-be ex or ex is doing this, you need to be able to have communication with him or her and understand and be knowledgeable about this issue, because it's there and it's happening. So if you can share with your ex or soon-to-be ex the damaging effects of parental alienation and how everybody should try to work together. I mean, there's legislation out there now that's going to promote shared parenting. It's been out there for 14 years in Illinois. Many other states have it. But shared parenting isn't always the answer for parental alienation. If you have a narcissist who is an alienator, it's very difficult to combat, especially backed with a very powerful lawyer. And most target parents, the parent who is cut from the child's life, have been financially devastated. So it's very difficult to fight. But if you can have honest and open communication with your children about the fact that it's okay to love both of your parents and your grandparents and your aunts and uncles and cousins, then possibly that child has enough wherewithal to avoid or fight the conflict that exists and is being implanted in that child's mind by the alienator.
And determine that there are lies going on. I mean, it's a hard line to walk because you don't want to call your spouse a liar. On the other hand, the children need to know the truth. And the truth is that you love your children and so do the grandparents. Yeah. And that both parents are there for the child. But it's just it's a very, very hard syndrome. One of the hardest things I deal with in my legal world. Jill, thank you so much for joining us. And do you have any organizations or any contact information that would be helpful to people?
Sure. Our site is paaousa.org. So Parental Alienation Awareness Organization, USA.org. And you can find us there if you have questions. They can contact me anytime. Everything's all over the internet. So Google my name. It's there. We're happy to help and be a sort of resource clearinghouse for people who are struggling with where to go and what to do.
Jill, thank you so much for joining us and you have a good evening.
Thanks, Karen.
Right.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. We're going to be taking your legal calls, 981-7200, 312-981-7200. You'll talk to Ben. You're going to tell Ben your legal problem, a little bit about it, as quickly as you can, and we'll get you on the air, and we'll try to address it as best we can. Call me. 981-7200, 312-981-7200. We got a little late start, but we're going all the way to 9 o'clock taking your legal questions. And we are getting some text about the guest that we just had. Hi, Karen. I'm a divorced dad that has had my kids turned against me because of my ex. It's so very hard to deal with. It was nice to hear your conversation. Great show. I'm so sad for you. It's a very, very sad situation. And we had a texter, Janet, who said, I heard your last guest. How do you advise the judge of the dangers of parental alienation? And I'm going to read between the lines. I think that judges are now becoming more aware that parents sometimes badmouth each other, which causes problems in the relationships between that parent and the children. But there are some judges who don't believe there's such a thing. They think that if a child doesn't want to see a parent, there's probably a really good reason. And sometimes there is a good reason, but sometimes not. And my view is that children really love their parents. And unless there's something really horrible going on in the household, the fact that the child doesn't want to see dad or mom, and usually they don't want to see the grandparents either, or the aunts and uncles, or the cousins, which doesn't make any sense. Even if mom is doing something really terrible, what is her mother doing? And what are the aunts and uncles doing? What are the cousins doing? So these children are having these memories that are good memories erased by someone who's saying, this is a bad person and you should be afraid of them. So I think how you advise a judge is you have to, first of all, have a very good lawyer who is schooled in what parental alienation is. And I think that most parents who have this issue in their lives should do the research for the lawyer and try to have the lawyer put into writing the literature on this and to cite to the literature that the psychiatrists and psychologists and child psychologists have written about and the studies they've done to show what parental alienation is, why it's parental alienation, what the signs are, and that your situation falls into that. It's also very important to show the judge how horrible it is, because a lot of judges will say, well, Johnny's not getting along with his dad, but, you know, he'll grow up and he'll be fine. Well, that's not always the case. And in fact, during a divorce, that is the end of some relationships that children have with their parents forever. And those children who grow up have horrible relationships. They, if you look at the statistics, a lot of them have drug and alcohol problems. They have higher rates of suicide, and they do not do very well in life for the most part because of this horrible wrenching of the relationship. So it needs to be brought to the judge's attention in an intelligent and informative way. There is a texter from 630 saying, this is a touchy subject. We have a situation in our family where the mother is alienated from the children. If you heard her story, you might think it's a case of alienation by the father, but rather keeping the children protected from abusive situation. Not going to go into details, but the mother believes it's a case. The children were sexually assaulted at her home during visitation. The children were not believed for years. These cases are complicated, not always easily understood at a glance. Well, and you're right. This is not parental alienation. This is not even, I wouldn't even call it alienation. This is what I call estrangement. And estrangement in the world of child custody cases and family law means that the children are not friendly with a parent, but for good reason. It's not because they were alienated. It's because they were abused, or something was going on as horrible as this texter is telling me. And that is a real reason. So you're right. Sometimes people are accused of parental alienation when in fact it's the parent who's doing something terrible and abusive. And sometimes there is a false accusation of sexual abuse or physical abuse, and it really is just plain parental alienation. So yes, you're right. These things, you don't want to use the wrong terms with these things. All right, let's go to 847. And remember, my number here is 981-7200. Karen, my wife and I have considered moving out of the country for retirement, Costa Rica. Can I come with you? What are the legal pitfalls we might encounter? Example, will our wills and trusts still be valid? You know, that's a really good question. And what I tell people is when you move, even to another state, you might want to have your estate plan revisited, just because it could be that you can get a better tax deal, or the law in the new state might deal with your assets and your issues in a different way. Generally speaking, though, if you say in your will that you're going to have the will probated in Illinois, then it would stay probated in Illinois. The problem is if one party, if you move to Costa Rica, which is a long way away, and one party dies and you need to deal with that, do you really want to come back up to Chicago for all the time that it takes to get the matters resolved? Hopefully you have a trust, which would be an easy way to maybe distribute the funds and to deal with the estate plan without going through probate. But I would definitely talk to a lawyer who might have connections in Costa Rica. Talk to a person here who has connections. And certainly when you go down there, find a lawyer and determine how things work there. It's kind of a hard thing, because you're going to have a hard time probably finding a lawyer, even here in Chicago with all the good lawyers we have, who knows what the law is in Costa Rica. So that's my best advice to you, but I'm glad you're thinking about it, and it's very good to think ahead like that, because you don't want to be in a foreign country and have it be a surprise. I had a text from Joan in the first hour. She said, why does one need a disability lawyer? What do they do to help? So disability is available through Social Security, and that is when you have some sort of disability, mental or physical, that prevents you from working. And if you get that disability, it pays you a modest sum per month. But for most people who have a disability and cannot work, it's something that they need to live on. So it's very, very important to them and to their families. So generally what I advise people is to apply for it yourself. Get all your medical records together, whatever the diagnosis has been. If you have more than one doctor who can diagnose, whether it's depression, whether it's epilepsy, whether it's something very physical that prevents you from working in your field, put it together and submit it. Many times Social Security denies your coverage, and at that point is when you need a lawyer. And at that point, you have to appeal it, and it's a very technical process, and it's very difficult to do it yourself. If you don't do it right, you're going to lose, and you could lose a lot of benefits that you very well need. So I have lawyers who are colleagues of mine who I work with. I have one in particular. I know that my texter was from the 414 area code, which is Milwaukee, and I know that he practices in the general area of the Chicago, Milwaukee, Indiana area. These things go into federal court, and he would be a very good referral for Joan. Let's see if there's any other text here. I had a very nice caller, Kathy from Huntley, called me a couple weeks ago, and she asked me, I'm a party to a lawsuit in McHenry County. My lawyer's bills contain charges for paralegals. What do paralegals do, and what are their qualifications? That's a good question, and paralegals are all different kinds of people. Paralegals can be go to paralegal school, and they can have a certificate. They can be anybody. They can be people who are lawyers who are just practicing as paralegals. They can be legal secretaries who just know a little bit more who are doing paralegal type work. So there's no real qualification or there's no bar exam that they have to take. And so it really depends. And some paralegals do a lot of work that lawyers do. Obviously, they can't go to court. They can't sign pleadings. They can't draft wills. But they can do research and they can do paperwork and they can kind of get your case ready. In my office, when I can use a paralegal, I do because it's cheaper for the client. So if I have drafting that needs to be done, I have that paralegal perhaps draft the initial document. And then, of course, I look it over and I edit it and I make sure it's legally correct. But in this case, Kathy is in a lawsuit in McHenry County. So the paralegals, in that case, I really don't know. It looks like it was a commercial litigation case that involved a business. So it could be that the paralegals were putting the documents in order, preparing the lawyers for court, maybe even filing things, putting together documents that need to be attached to some of the pleadings. So there's a lot of busy work that lawyers do in litigation, a lot of busy work that it's better to have the paralegals do. But certainly you are entitled to know who these paralegals are, how many years of experience they have. You can see from the bill, hopefully, what they're doing and why they're doing it. And if you have a problem with the paralegals doing it, discuss it with your lawyer. For the most part, your lawyer will probably tell you what I said, which is, you know, you're better off having the paralegal do this work than me because it's going to be more expensive. I'm going to read another. This is a follow-up to the texter who had the alienation issue. Even with all of this, the father still tries to have the children maintain a relationship with the mother. He knows what's best for the children. I even sat with her in court as the judge ruled the children be given to the father. I feel awful for her. She herself is the product of an abusive childhood. Yes. So this was the case where the woman maybe subjected her children to sexual abuse by someone outside the marriage, and she lost her children for it. And that's really a horrible thing to have happen to the children. And again, we understand why the children probably don't want to see her because they're very upset that they weren't believed. We're going to continue to take your legal questions. 981-7200, 312-981-7200. This is the Karen Conti Show.
When I heard her say, yeah.
We have 30 minutes for legal questions. Does anyone have any comments or any questions for me? Call me at 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200, or text to that number. I'm going to give out my office information in case you would like to speak with me or ask me a question in private. My number at the office is 312-332-7800. You'll be put into my voicemail, and it's a private voicemail. Leave me all the information, not too long, but leave me the facts, where you live, what happened, when it happened, what you're looking for, and what your issues are. And the best way to do it is an email, because then I can kind of get right back to you if I have a referral for you. For instance, if you need a personal injury lawyer or you need a disability lawyer or something that I don't do, I can send you to the right people. Or wills and trust. I know that's a big one. People always want my view on who they should hire for wills, trust, estate plans. That email address, and you might want to just put this, write this down, because you never know when you're going to need a lawyer. It's wgn@askkarenconti.com, K-A-R-E-N-C-O-N-T-I. Again, give me your name, give me your information, when things happen, where you are, what county you're in, and I'm happy to help you. And I like helping people. I like trying to steer them in the right direction and getting them to the right lawyer if that's a possibility. 981-7200, give me a call here. Our phone lines are open. If you have any comments about the Blagojevich pardon, anyone has any opinion? Should he be pardoned by President Donald Trump? Do you think he will be? Do you have a problem with that? Do you think it's time? I'd like to hear what you have to say. Let's go to the texters. A friend drives a ready-mixed truck and was in an accident where the car was at fault. He can't seem to find a lawyer to represent him to sue the owner of the car. Any suggestions? Well, the question is, why are you having a why is this person having trouble finding a lawyer? The question is, who got the ticket? And that's what I want to know. You say he drives a truck and there were an accident where the car was at fault. So what you're saying is the ticket gave the ticket to the car. The question is, were there injuries? Was the guy in the truck injured? Was the car damaged? If the car was damaged and the person inside was not really injured, a lot of lawyers don't take cases that have minimal damage. When I say damage, I mean economic loss, because lawyers who take these cases will file them. Cost about $500, $400 or $500 to file it out of pocket. Then they get litigated sometimes for a year. You go to court, on and on. It could take hours and hours of case. So no lawyer wants to handle a case where there's really no economic loss. So let's just say the truck was damaged and it was $2,000, but there's no physical injuries. The lawyer's just not going to take that case for a third. They're going to pay a third to the lawyer, and that's just not enough to even bother to file the lawsuit. So I asked that texter from the 815 to get over to me, send me an email at my office, and give me the facts, give me the amount of damage, and what county it was in, and I will give you my best advice. And if I think it's a case that someone might take, I will refer you to a lawyer who I think might take it. Deanna from the 630 area code says, Rod's, meaning Rod Blagojevich, has been in jail long enough at taxpayer expense, but I don't want him pardoned or exonerated. Kind of both. You're saying both. You think he's been in jail long enough, but you don't want him pardoned, meaning, so there's difference. You know, I guess I should explain that. There's a general concept called clemency, executive clemency. It's in the Constitution. The president has an absolute right to grant clemency to people who were prosecuted and convicted under federal law. So if the person was accused and convicted under state law, the president has no authority to do it. It would have to be the governor. So President Donald Trump has complete authority to grant clemency to Rod Blagojevich. He doesn't have to have a reason. He doesn't have to have a right reason or any reason at all. And can it be political? Can it be based upon what he thinks? And even if it's false, he can do it for any reason at all. I think that almost all commutations, clemency grants, pardons are very, very controversial, because half the population thinks it was a good idea and half the population thinks it wasn't. So under the umbrella of clemency, we have four things. We have pardon, which is a complete exoneration of the crime. And the commutation, which is, I think, what President Trump is talking about, is the substitution of a less severe sentence, meaning he served enough time, we're going to get him out of jail. Maybe we'll waive some of his fines that he has, and maybe the length of his parole will be shortened. So it's a changing of the sentencing. It's a changing of the punishment. So those are the two main things, pardon and commutation. Then we have amnesty, which is rarely used, but it was used in the 70s where Carter granted amnesty to the draft dodgers. And he said, we're not going to prosecute them. We're going to say this prospectively. No one is going to be prosecuting those people who evaded the draft. And the fourth is a reprieve, which is really just a temporary suspension of a punishment. So you see that in the cases of the death penalty, where a reprieve is granted, maybe pending another appeal. So those are the four things. And we have another texter in the 847 saying, Blagojevich served enough time. One condition of the commutation should be several years of community service, working in a homeless shelter, tutoring kids in a disadvantaged schools. Love your show, Laura. Thank you, Laura. That would be a good an end to this. I know a lot of people believe that he should serve his full sentence, and I guess I feel this way because I have represented criminal defendants, and I've seen how long it really means to be in jail. 7 years in jail, it doesn't matter that it's not the maximum security place. It's probably a decent prison as far as prisons go. It is punishment. It is. You have severe limitations on what you can do for good reason. People who are convicted need to be punished. 7 years is a long, long time. He has been punished. And what really is terrible is how his family has been punished. And his children didn't do anything in this regard. And I just think it's for what he did, he probably served enough time. I don't feel so strongly about it that I'm going to fight people on it, because I understand that people are really shamed. You know, it's a shameful thing what he did, and we don't like to see our politicians do these kinds of things. But listen, I'm not even sure there's a deterrent effect on the sentence, because right after Blagojevich, we have how many more politicians getting indicted, and it doesn't seem to phase anybody that Blagojevich was given 7 years. I am not sure. I'm going to 312 texter. I have two adult children who I have not talked to in 6 years because of parental alienation. One daughter recently reconnected with me, but is still very guarded. Glad you are addressing this topic and thankful some judges are aware of it. It's been so painful to lose your children this way. I'm really sorry to hear that. And when I hear these stories, I know from talking to my clients who have been alienated that it's almost worse than losing a child to death in a way, because that child has no connection with you. The child is brainwashed. The child does not. You know the child's there, but you can't talk to them. And they have built around their life this idea that you are a horrible person for no good reason. And it's just very hard on parents. And I know a lot of parents who suffer greatly because of these issues. Let's take a break now. And when we come back, we are going to continue to take your legal questions. I'm going to get to Dee Dee in Geneva. The show with a happy song. Thanks for the happy song, Ben. This is the Karen Conti Show. I'm going to be taking your legal questions or comments for the last few minutes here. 981-7200. I'll give out my number at the office in case you would like to speak with me personally. 312-332-7800, or better yet, email me at wgn@askkarenconti.com. I can't really give you specific legal advice, but I can kind of steer you in the right direction, maybe give you a site where you can get some information, give you my opinion on where you should go. Or what I'd like to do best is to refer you to a lawyer in your area who might be good for your particular issue that you have. Let's go to Dee Dee in Geneva. Hi, Dee Dee. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. How are you?
Hi, fine. Thank you. How are you?
Good.
I am wondering about a real estate transaction, whether or not the full legal name has to be on it.
Okay. Are you using a realtor?
No.
Okay. So you're doing a contract for the sale of a piece of property.
Right.
Why would you not put the name on it? I mean, it seems like it's a fundamental thing. You want to say who's selling it to whom, right?
No, but what I'm asking is if it has to be the full legal name versus like a nickname, or not the full legal name.
Okay, so the name of the person who's buying it or selling it?
Selling. Well, both, I guess, but selling.
I mean, I'm not a real estate lawyer, but I think I would take a look at who owns the house. What is the legal name of, who's on the deed? Is the deed in the formal name, or is it in the nickname?
Okay, so it's whatever's on the deed. I don't know.
I would say whatever's on the deed, because you want to make sure that whoever holds it is giving all right title and interest to the person who's selling it. And that person should have his full name on it as well.
Okay, so if the name were like Kenneth Robert, you know, first name and middle name, but he went by the middle name and Robert. Or Bob were used.
You know, you could do? You could even put like Kenneth Robert Davis and then put in parens Ken, Rob Davis or something. You know, you could say his full name, his legal name is, but formally, or you could say known as, and then put his known as name.
Okay.
I mean, that probably solves the problem. But just be careful, because when you're selling a piece of property, you want to just make sure you do this correctly. And I take it you don't want to hire a lawyer to do any of this, right?
Well, no, there is one involved.
Okay.
But I don't know who it is.
Okay. And I think it's always good when you're buying and selling a piece of property to make sure you get it right, because you're going to want to record the deed and you want to do it correctly. And you want to make sure that there's no as is and all of that stuff. So be careful when you do that and make sure the lawyer knows what they're doing. I don't like the idea of a lawyer not looking over this transfer document. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Good luck, Dee Dee. Take care.
Let's
go to Tom in Lake Station. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Well, hello. I'm a first-time caller, but I just had happened to wander in on that conversation about Rod Blagojevich.
Sure.
And I think it would be just with Rod's talent and all that he could do for the city of Chicago and all their problems, I think if the president ask him to just for maybe a 2-year period work as a mentor or some type of thing for the, you know, to tell, you know, with all his talent, I'm sure they could find a spot where he would help the community and be able to be with his family every night, and it would be a great solution to several problems.
I like that idea. I don't know that I've ever seen a president put those kinds of restraints on a commutation, but I think it would be a very good diplomatic thing to do, not to mention practical, because like you're saying, and I'm hearing from my texters too, hey, you know, we don't like paying his taxes. I'd rather have him be out here paying taxes. And, you know, no one's supporting his children, and how are his children going to go to school? And what you're saying is put him in the community. He's obviously intelligent. I met him several times before he went to jail. He's very charming. He knows a lot of stuff. He's very vibrant and got a lot of energy. He would do well in that kind of situation. And I understand from talking to people who know him that he's doing that in prison, which, you know, good for him. He should be doing something positive.
Yeah, if he does it in prison, he could come out and be with his family, do it for, you know, I'm sure they could put him in charge of a certain thing. I'm sure they're looking at many programs to stop the violence in Chicago. And this would be, he would be a person that you could actually put in charge of a program.
Great. Okay. All right. Then thank you.
But it was only an idea. So
I like that. I like that idea.
People expand on it.
And maybe President Trump is listening to my show.
Tell the president.
Okay.
You know.
I've got the hotline
okay,
here, Tom.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thank
Very much.
Take care. One of the reasons Chicago has such a high crime rate is widely known your sentence will be reduced. I believe when a sentence is given, that sentence is mentioned, is carved out, period. The sentence, he's a criminal. His father-in-law even said that of him. Those who live in glass houses should not throw stones. I see a lot of anger. I see people who, well, we in the city have seen a lot of corruption and a lot of people doing bad things, and we do have a lot of crime. But I'm not sure. I respect your opinion, and I don't know that criminals think about the fact that their sentences will be reduced when they commit crimes. I'm one for, hey, you know what, if you have an illegal handgun and you commit a crime, I think there should be serious ramification to that, because then I think there will be fewer people using illegal handguns. I do believe that. But politicians changing their ways because of Blagojevich, you know, I like to think that, but I'm not sure. Put him in charge of the Get Madigan Out movement. I'm not sure what that means, but it sounds interesting. Let's go to Richard. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show.
Yes. Hi.
Hi.
I've read it in the paper, too, and my attorney's talked about it, you know, to have both a power of attorney and a living will. But after reading them over, if I have both, which one's going to control if, you know, you get to the point of pulling the plug? As the doctor said, no, 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 and then your whoever you appointed on your power of attorney for health care says, well, in my opinion, you know, his life support should be disconnected.
So your question,
which one's going to control?
Which one is going to control? Okay, well, that's a good question. There's just, I'm going to, you know what, I'm going to put you on hold just because I got a little bit of an echo here, Richard. Are you listening on your radio?
No, I have that off.
Okay, all right, well then. Can you turn it on when I turn you off? Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I just had a really bad echo there. Sorry. So, Richard, we have two things. We have a power of attorney for health care and a power of attorney for business decisions. And those kick in when you can't handle your own situation. So your concern is in the area of the power of attorney. And when you read these forms, it'll say there are several choices about what you want to do. Like you want every single last way to try to revive you to be used, or you want just only certain things to be used. You don't want feeding tubes. It's all there. I can't recite what the options are, but you will get to choose which one you want. Now, a doctor will not let somebody sever your life and give you medicine to kill you. So that's not an issue. The question is, how much care do you want? If you're in a coma and you're brain dead, do you want someone to continue life support in that situation? So that's something that you can talk with your doctor about, and probably a good estate planning lawyer as well. There is not a fight. The doctor will say, we have the options now. Now it's your turn to make the decision. And that person that you choose is going to listen to your will and listen, when I say your will, what you wanted him or her to do. So there's not going to be a conflict between doctor and the person that you appoint as power of attorney. I hope that makes sense. Blago says, my 630 texter is a corrupt sleazeball who needs to serve every day of a sentence. He shook down a hospital, for God's sake. Yeah, you know, one of the things that people forget about within all of the things, selling the Senate seat was the kind of big allegation that everyone heard. But there was the one that I think really offended a lot of people, is that he allegedly, I guess it wasn't allegedly because he's been convicted of it, he was convicted of shaking down the hospital in order to get campaign funds, which is kind of a really low thing to do, and that really angers a lot of people. So I hear you. I hear you loud and clear. Don't be the fourth Illinois governor to go to prison in the last 50 years, and you wouldn't need to complain about long prison sentences. Yep, there's a lot of anger here. I hear a lot of anger, but I'm not going to hear any more anger.